and welcome back to the Ice World Podcast. I'm Nadia Frontier. This is a unique episode combining four interviews from Dutch researchers who work in collaboration with the British Antarctic Survey. The Dutch Research Council, on behalf of the Netherlands Polar Programme, has supported researchers working in Antarctica between Rothera Research Station and Cygni Island, as we'll hear about during this episode. Their work spans the terrestrial Antarctic islands, life below the water, and they conduct controlled experiments in neat containers that form part of the Gerritz Laboratory, which is located opposite the Bonner Laboratory at Rothera Research Station. It's been so nice over the years to interact with some of the Dutch researchers, and I'm really sorry to them if I'm pronouncing their name wrong. First up, I speak to Marijke Bach.
So my name is Marijke, and I am a PhD student at the University of Groningen. And I had the pleasure to come down to Rothera and to work in the Bonner Lab for 6 weeks to do a little science project here.
A little science project.
A little science project.
Amazing. Right, before we get onto your science project, because that is going to be the focus of this talk, can you just give me a little bit of your background? Because you have actually been to Antarctica before, but on a ship.
Yeah, that is correct. So, well, actually, I'm a biochemist by training. So in my bachelor's, I did biochemistry. And then I, followed my love for the ocean, I guess, and studied marine microbiology in Bremen in Germany. And afterwards, I started a PhD on microalgae. So that is what I'm doing at the moment. Actually, my project was planned to go twice to Rothera and then do a short season and a long season afterwards. But then because of COVID and a lot of changes, we decided it would be more beneficial to go on Polarstern on a cruise. So that was earlier this year. And I had the pleasure to join a research cruise, which was an oceanographic cruise with a lot of biology added to it. So I was joining the cruise because I was doing a chlorophyll analysis. So I was filtering for pigment analysis and get like an overview of chlorophyll distribution. And then I had my own little project going on the ship. So we went for 8 weeks, starting in Cape Town and ending in Punta Arenas, and went through the Weddell Sea. And I filtered a lot of water from the CTDs, and then I also got to go on the ice and have a look at ice algae, because that is my main project. So we were taking ice cores and then doing experiments to measure DMSP production and primary productivity in the ice.
So when you actually got lowered onto the ice, I've seen those baskets before that kind of like just hover above the ice, because you're obviously being deployed from a ship. So how do you know how safe the ice is to actually then take a core on it? How did you access the ice?
Yeah, there's different ways of accessing the ice. So one is, as you mentioned, like the basket that they will lower onto the ice. So basically it's coming, like the crane of the ship is lowering the basket onto the ice with us in it. And then we have like a small drill where we would check how thick the ice is and how stable. And so the basket is placed on the ice. Someone is leaning over, just drilling through the ice and kind of checking how thick and how safe the ice is. If it is safe enough to go, someone will go out and will explore the rest of the ice floe where we landed, and then make sure it is safe. And then we can start working, and then work is done on the ice. And then everyone goes back into the basket and back onto the ship. And then we also had an occasion where it wasn't safe to go on the ice, because we were in the midst of pancake ice floes. So it was actually very slushy and very, well, we didn't expect that it would hold the basket. It did. And when we were coring, so we were just leaning over the basket, coring, taking the cores into the basket, and then processing the cores on the ice.
Wow.
In the basket. And it turned out that it was thick enough to hold us, because it was actually like up to six to eight pancakes stacked over on top of each other. So it basically was holding the basket.
So you cored through the pancake ice?
Yeah.
You were actually sampling the pancake ice?
Yeah.
And what was the average length of your cores?
So we went at the beginning of the year, so that's Antarctic autumn. Mm-hmm. So then sea ice is just growing. That was like the interest that we had, to see what is happening in sea ice that is just
early
forming.
Formation.
We had several types, of course. The pancake ice was probably like maybe like 20 to 30 centimeters then.
Do you get to the base of the ice? Because the aim is that you're sampling the ice algae. So you want to core right to the base. Why do you want to look at the ice algae? What's important about it?
For me, most fascinating is that there is life in ice at all. So that is, I think, a pretty cool, because you think of ice really as some very not hospitable environment. And I think it's pretty crazy that there's these brine channels that form in the ice, and there's so much life and so much happening in there. We are particularly interested in sea ice algae because they do produce a compound called DMSP, and that can be turned into a gas which can be interchanged with the atmosphere, and in the atmosphere is involved in cloud formation. So we are really looking at the processes of under which circumstances algae are producing more or less of this compound. And why sea ice? It's because usually when the ice breaks up in the in the spring, and then you get massive blooms usually associated with melting ice, and that that is where the highest concentrations of DMSP or DMSP production or DMS are being measured. So that is why we are interested in that particular bit.
Excellent. So let's talk about Rothera. What did you want to do at Rothera? What was your initial intentions, and how have you adapted?
Yeah, so originally we wanted to sample sea ice. That didn't happen.
Because this has been a very, very low sea ice year, and you guys arrived at the start of the polar summer, and unfortunately all of our sea ice had broken up.
Yeah, exactly. So we had to adapt our plans a little bit. So what we did in the end is we went to the long-term research site that is here in the middle of the bay, and collected water samples and used that for incubation experiments under different pH conditions. But then your samples actually came quite as a pleasant surprise, because Nadia collected for us some benthic species while diving, and it turned out that these were almost pure cultures of single algae species, or at least dominated communities by one species, and that was diatom species mainly. And so we did experiments with that as well, so that was really cool.
And what will you take away from this experience?
I think the best is that you meet so many inspiring people, and that is not only scientists, but that is also other people who are really dedicated to the work that they are doing here. And I think it has just been a really great experience. I absolutely loved every minute of it. And doing field work, it's just such a privilege that you come down to this really special place and can be part of a community for a rather short time, in our case, like 6 weeks. Sounds like a lot, but it's really going so fast. And then I think the people is which make it the best. And then not forgetting the panorama that we have when we work in the office. I mean, that's just, it's just brilliant. I mean, what can you wish more? So I'm just really happy.
That's amazing. And I wish you the best of luck for completing your PhD. And it's been so nice having you and Maria and Jacqueline in the Bonner Lab, and you've given such a beautiful presence. So thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Mahaika is still based at the University of Groningen in her first year writing up her PhD. As a refreshing break, she's just told me that she's taking her bike next month via ferry across the North Sea from the Netherlands to Harwich in the east of England, to then cycle a 700-kilometre round trip to the southwest of the UK. Good luck, Mahaika. Next up, I am joined by Swan So, a polar microbial ecologist. Swan was using genetics and physiology to document the spatial and temporal microbial community across a depth gradient within the Southern Ocean. I enjoyed briefly helping her out while she was collecting continual water samples from Rothera Wharf. She worked all through the night. I interviewed Swan in 2022 when she was working for the Netherlands Institute for Sea Research, or shortened to NIOS. I am here with Swan So, and she is a postdoctoral researcher working with marine microbes.
Hi everyone, I'm Swan, and I am a postdoc working at the Royal Dutch Marine Institute, also known as the NIOS, and I've been in Rothera for close to 3 months now. collecting samples and doing research on marine microbes.
So you are working with us in the Bonner Laboratory and you are out on the boat sampling and collecting loads of water samples and you have your own laboratory facility. So can you give me a bit of an overview about what your key research questions have been this summer?
Right. So I think one of the main goals that we really want to achieve is actually expanding the molecular map of marine microbes. And by molecular map, I mean using DNA to characterize the microbial community. Yeah, that's just something that's been really, really understudied. And because of how important these microbes are in the marine environment, it's absolutely important to know who's living in the water.
So your aim is to categorize all the microbes in a specific layer of the water? What depths are you sampling from?
At the moment, most of the samples are from the top 15 meters. And the top 15 meters is pretty well mixed water. So we're looking at a pretty homogeneous layer in the first 15 meters. But I did also manage to collect some samples from the deep at about 500 meters. That's something a bit newer for my research group, but definitely something very interesting because, again, there's next to no research that has been done on deep sea microbes, certainly in Antarctica. There is such a huge area of deep sea, and in fact, if you think about it, most of the seawater is deep sea water. The surface is just the tip
a
of the iceberg.
Representation.
Exactly,
like
tip
your,
of the iceberg.
Like your
So yeah, there's a lot more to explore as well in the deep waters, and that's probably our second or third goal of the trip. The second goal being, so after we characterize the microbial community, we also want to explore how the microbes talk to each other. We want to see how they communicate. So just like us humans, the microbes also communicate with each other, and they send signals to each other or things like that. So my bachelor's, I did biotechnology, and in my final year project, that was when I had my first taste of molecular work. So I decided to work with my molecular biology professor, who had a really amazing project where we actually sampled some fish feces and gut, and we isolated bioluminescent bacteria in pure culture form, and then we managed to sequence a gene that controls the intensity of the bioluminescence emitted by the bacteria. Yeah, one of the key genes in these kinds of bacteria. So it's a pretty common bioluminescent bacteria in a lot of seafood and aquaculture. And there is a link between the bioluminescence and how the bacteria infects the seafood. So one of the main reasons why they started looking at it was because the aquaculture industry was suffering quite a bit from a lot of the fishes and prawns, squids getting infected by this bacteria and affecting their numbers. So there's some sort of link as well between how bright the bioluminescent bacteria glows and how extensively they infect the fishes.
That was like your first insight into molecular
yes.
techniques.
Yes.
After your bachelor's, what's your next route?
After my bachelor's, I decided to pursue a master's. University had actually moved campuses at that time. It was a brand new campus. It was built on land that was surrounded by a pretty extensive number of disused tin mines, a lot of which have been repurposed for aquaculture, lotus culture, and some of them's just abandoned, but lots of these ponds littered around the university. And what interested us was what sort of microbes inhabited these ponds, particularly those that were repurposed for aquaculture, because there's obviously a lot of nutrient recycling going on in ponds naturally, and as well as when you have aquaculture, you obviously have higher inputs of things like ammonia, some methane as well. So it was important to, I guess, understand how nutrients are cycled in these ponds. So the lotus culture ponds have much lower levels of toxic metals. Coincidentally, there was a species of a methane oxidizer that had the ability to break down the toxic metals. Yeah, so it shows that the community really adapts to its environment and makes use of whatever substrate it has as well in that particular pond, which is really amazing.
So moving away from your academic background, you've worked in Antarctica or you've worked in the Southern Ocean. What's that next step?
So after I finished my master's project, I worked for a bit in commercial. So I was working for Epinoff. And for those of you who aren't familiar, they are a pretty big name in manufacturing micropipettes. But then I decided that I really wanted to go back to academics. I wanted to go back to research, which really interested me. And the opportunity came along where there was a PhD project in Tasmania in Australia, and I decided to go for it. And I, again, used DNA to characterize these microbial communities in these different water masses. That's my first introduction to Southern Ocean and Antarctic world. It was on the RV Investigator. It was the newest Australian research vessel at the time, and that was in 2015.
How many samples did you have to process?
Well, so from that particular voyage, I think we managed to get 1,200.
How many lab hours is that?
Oh, I don't remember.
Too many.
I think just DNA extraction would have taken up probably a month of lab work, extracting by hand every day.
What would you say that, drawing on those past experiences and your experience now, what are the greatest challenges that you have come across working in the Southern Ocean and now in Antarctica itself?
That's quite a tough question. Challenges, definitely the weather conditions, and with especially open ocean samples, rough seas, always a problem. I was seasick quite a bit for the first week, I would say, on those voyages. Collecting the samples themselves and even just organizing such an extensive voyage is a pretty mammoth task that involves many, many different parties. And I'm very fortunate to be able to join such an amazing voyage to collect all these samples. A lot of the work that we're doing is very delicate because we have to also make sure that there's no contamination from the lab environment, there's no cross-contamination, so we have to be really careful when we handle the water and filter the water. Filtering the water takes quite a long time because you can't just use very high pressures to push them through. They are very delicate things, and if you use very high pressures, you're going to damage the cells, and that will also affect the downstream processes. So low pressures, a lot of patience, and I would say probably maybe the next more challenging thing, because we're in such a remote environment and because of how much effort it takes to collect samples, you need to very strategically pick points in the ocean to have a good representation, I guess, of the coverage. And it's getting better now in terms of characterizing the microbes across a larger coverage in the Southern Ocean. But I definitely foresee that it will still take many years to have actually a good, accurate picture of most of the microbes in the Southern Ocean.
What do you take away from your time here in Antarctica? Good.
It's been a really interesting time here. I'd have to say, plan well, but expect a lot of unexpected stuff because the weather is so unpredictable here. You just have to go with the flow and try your best to work with the weather. Yeah, despite all the weather challenges, it's definitely a very cool place to do science, and I would highly recommend it to anyone.
Thanks, Juan. Thanks so much. And hopefully we'll see you back here again in the future.
Yes, I hope I'll have an opportunity to come back again and study more marine microbes in Antarctica.
Swan is continuing her postdoctoral journey, but has moved from the Netherlands and is now based in France at a science institute called Laboratoire des Sciences du Numérique in Nantes. And whilst doing science, is also busy learning the French language and sitting French exams. It was really nice to bump into her last summer at the SCAR, that is the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research Conference in Chile. Next up, I interviewed Steph Bockhorst, who has been studying fascinating questions surrounding the interactions between extreme Antarctic plants and their associated invertebrates. He even brought a small film crew along with him in the 2022-2023 Rothera season, so it was great to have them on station and see their footage. I hope it makes it to Netherlands TV. Although these invertebrates are tiny, they are actually, in fact, the top predators of polar terrestrial ecosystems.
Hi, I'm Steph. I'm from the Netherlands. I work in Amsterdam. And the first time I came down here was to the Antarctic was in December 2003, where I started my research on the impacts of climate warming and how the terrestrial ecosystems, so the mosses and lichens that live here and the small animals that live within them, how they would kind of be respond to a temperature rise. So we set up these experiments, small greenhouses on Sydney Island, but also here at Rothera Research Station. And I've been coming back intermittently every so many years to see how the vegetation and the animals that live within them are changing. So that's sort of a long-term running project that we have. the project started 18 years ago, but I had a couple of years where I just couldn't come down south. But
did it continue when you weren't here down south with other, other collaborators that continued it? So it really almost is a...
Yeah, it's been running for 18 years continuously.
Data set. That's incredible. Amazing data. And are you, from the analyses of this data, what are the key trends that you started to detect?
Well, it's interesting. So we set them up in a very moss-dominated site. So actually everything is dominated by a number of moss species. And surprisingly enough, they're not responding at all. They don't. So the temperature goes up by about 1.5 degrees during the summer months. And they're not too fussed about it. They're not growing taller, they're not growing quicker. We don't see changes in the community. Everything is pretty much stable.
So compared to the control, these greenhouses are able to elevate the inside temperature 1 degrees hotter than ambient in this system that you've created. And then you have a control to mimic or to compare with ambient conditions.
Yeah.
And nothing is happening.
No, nothing
with
happening.
With a 1 degree increase.
Yeah.
Are you quite surprised by those results? Or do you think that Antarctic moss have got a specific tolerance?
At first I was surprised, but then I started diving more into the microhabit that the species actually live in. And then you see that on a sunny day, the moss temperature can go up to 30, 35 degrees. And then when the sun dips a little bit during nighttime, it can freeze. So within 24 hours, it can go from minus 5 to plus 35. So if you just increase it by 1 degree...
It's not going to have much.
It's not going to have much on the physiological characteristics of the moss. Yeah. But the interesting thing was, so we also had a set of these greenhouses on lichens. And there was actually, we saw after a couple of years, a lot of the lichens were disappearing. So they weren't coping at all.
Interesting.
With increased temperature. And that really made us think. So again, we had a good look at the microclimate and we saw exactly the same thing. The temperature during, even in the control plots, it grew up from 35 to minus 5 during a 24-hour temperature day cycle. And just made us still wonder, why would 1 or 2 degrees increase have such an impact?
If they respond in the same way to the mosses, the lichen.
And the lichens, are most often, they're more hardy. They're very easy. If they dry out, they're just inactive, they're fine with that.
Yeah.
And the moment they're re-moisted, they just become active again. So basically on and off switches.
Like intertidal plants.
Yeah.
They can just take that desiccation.
Yeah, there's no problem there.
So they should be resilient.
They should have been resilient. But one thing we noticed was that actually the small greenhouses, they don't have a roof. So during winter, they accumulate a lot more snow than the plots outside, so the control plots. And then we started looking at the winter temperatures, and they actually went up a lot, because when you've got a thick enough snow layer, it insulates the plants and the soil underneath from any kind of outside temperature. It could be minus 40 out here, but the mosses and lichens underneath would only be around zero, just around minus 5. And now it becomes tricky for the lichens, because they have this on and off switch very easily, just related through moisture. If you've got a thick snow layer, then the little bit of air space between the snow and the soil becomes very humid. So there's a lot of air humidity.
Moisture.
So the mosses are actually constantly wet. And that means they can be active. And they will be active.
The lichens.
The lichens will be active. Sorry, misspoke there. But that's a problem, of course, because if it's dark, they can only respire. So they use up carbon, their resources, and they do that whole winter round. And then in the summer months, they can do the photosynthesis because then they're suddenly light. But they can only do it when they're wet. And on a very sunny day, they can only photosynthesize right when they're wet. And then within 1 or 2 hours, the sun dries them out and they've got to stop.
Okay.
So there's only very tiny windows where they can actually be photosynthesizing during the day. And then if you do that year after year, you actually burn up all your resources during winter and you can't replenish them in summer, then eventually you're going to die. It's basically, you're running like mad during wintertime. You're not eating enough during the summer.
And then just burning up.
Yeah, and then disappeared.
But only some of the species of lichen.
Yeah.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Why are some of them able to tolerate? Do you think they will potentially burn out later? Do you still have these greenhouses in place?
There must be some differences in whether they are actually responding to those increased winter temperatures. And perhaps other ones are perhaps better at shutting off. Or they're actually able to increase the photosynthesis during summer more than the other ones.
And be more efficient.
Yeah.
That would be a really interesting
You would definitely need
to look at.
Yeah, do a lot of physiological work to really untangle that.
then let's talk about the herbivores that are associated with the primary producers. So yeah. I really liked your analogy. You did a great science talk the other day and talked about how in the Netherlands, your greatest and largest herbivore are the cows. And then here we've got springtails and mites.
Yeah.
What work do you do associated with those higher trophic levels?
We also follow them actually in these warming chambers. But again, we're not seeing much of a response. But one of the other projects we started looking at is actually where can we find most abundantly and the biodiversity patterns across the Antarctic. And we were sort of interested in, can we make predictions about where we find the highest biodiversity? So which areas should we be protecting against human influence and potentially climate change? And that wasn't that easy. Well, we did know that a moss creates a very moist environment, a more stable microclimate environment. And that really suits the springtails and mice really well. So most often we find the highest abundance among moss if you compare it to a lichen patch. We know that in general, herbivores would basically do better if you eat more healthy, if you eat more nutritious food. But that was never tested in the Antarctic. So we started thinking, so where could we find differences in the nutrient content of mosses and lichens? And then we started looking, well, actually, penguins and elephant seals, you can basically smell them. And we could, we really thought, well, this could be factors between a nutrient transfer from the ocean to land. So penguins and elephant seals and other seals, they eat in the sea where they consume a lot of nutrients and food. And they come on land and then they nest and they settle there. And then they do the number ones and number twos.
And they're recycling all of this food.
Yeah, all that food. And that can be taken up by the mosses and lichens. So that would allow us to test in a natural environment what increased nutrient availability could do for the biodiversity patterns of the springtails and mites. So we tested that simply by collecting mosses very close by a penguin colony and still further and further away inland. And we measured the nitrogen content and we measured the abundance and the diversity of all the springtails and mites we found in them. And yeah, lo and behold, we found really nice correlations there. So the more nitrogen you put into the system, the better off the springtails and mites are actually.
And where is the greatest hotspots of biodiversity in Antarctica?
That's a good question. It is somewhere along the Antarctic Peninsula.
The peninsula is kind of the hotspot.
That's definitely the hotspot, but mm-hmm. which specific point along the peninsula, I wouldn't know.
So how did the logistics of Antarctic sampling compare to your previous work?
And the biggest difference is that everything takes a long time in the Antarctic. Getting this, because
of course,
if you go to every basically country you go to, there's always a shop. If you forget something, you can buy it. If there's something you think, oh, it would work a lot better if we actually add some screws here, rebuild this a little bit, you can go to a shop and get it.
Exactly.
And it just doesn't exist in the Antarctic. You need to plan ahead, a year in ahead. What am I going to do? What do I need for it? What could break? What could I do to prevent it breaking? Or do I need to bring a second spare or a third spare or everything to make sure I can actually do my work? And then you need to send it off, in my case, to Cambridge, sometime in July. And then I get it back in January to actually start working on it. And there's another thing. For a very good reason, the Antarctic environment is protected by an Antarctic treaty system. So you need to get a permit to do work.
Yes.
But in the Netherlands, that takes a long time. It takes about 9 months. So if I want to do research in the Antarctic in December, I have to submit my permit in March. But if I come up with a new plan in May, I can't change the permit anymore. So I'm not allowed to then adapt that system. Technically, the permit is bound by laws, so it's some kind of contract. It's legally binding. So if you step out of it, there could be legal repercussions. Even if you could argument, well, it's got good logical...
It's got a scientific value
for it. And we're actually not actually doing any harm to the environment to such an extent that it would be detrimental.
There's very few people that get the opportunity to actually conduct research here, but then...
Yeah.
Is that what attracted you to come to Antarctica? Why would you want to base your research in a place where it is just tremendously difficult and you still do it? Yes, intermittently, but really, 18 years you've been pursuing a project in somewhere challenging.
Yeah.
Why?
I think part of it is probably the challenge itself. And it's a unique environment. There's nowhere on the planet where all the species that grow on that, they're so pressured in terms of the climatic and abiotic environments. It's so cold, so dry, there's so much UV light, and still they manage to thrive. I find that really amazing.
Everybody on station that is not necessarily a scientist, after your talk, they became acutely aware to the mosses and looking out for invertebrates, because it's, you almost get this perception when you're here that terrestrial life doesn't exist. And it's something that I've wrongly said in talks too, that I love sampling the marine environment and seeing all these vibrant colours, because there's almost nothing terrestrially. It's so barren. I mean, but then you've really brought to life that there is this whole ecosystem, an amazing Antarctic terrestrial web, which is incredible. My final question is, do you have hope for the future of Antarctic terrestrial ecosystems in response to climate change?
I would say there is. Actually, the ecosystems themselves will definitely be able to cope with an increase in temperature. That should be fine. Even changing snow and rain patterns, that they'll be able to cope. It might, some species may lose and some species may gain. I think the biggest threat is actually the introduction of vascular plants. So grasses and shrubs and things that may come in naturally from South America. But in that respect, actually, our activity here is the biggest threat, because we could actually be bringing seed of propagules, which could, especially if temperatures keep increasing, which could then result in a completely different and altered ecosystem. And I think that would be a real shame.
Are there propagules able to disperse across the Southern Ocean and remain viable and establish on land?
I think the seeds and spores from mosses and different vascular plants, I think they would definitely be able to survive air transport and potentially even transport over water. But another good factor could actually be birds. We're actually seeing more and more birds that we typically find in southern South America. Sometimes they just show up along the Antarctic Peninsula. Either they fly there or they get blown there. That had been being blown, of course. But yeah, they just sit around there, sandpipers, for instance, 10 or 15 of them. They seem to be doing okay, and then they probably migrate back again.
Wow. So thank you very much.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. Thanks.
We will finish this longer than usual episode with a very passionate scientist, PhD student Seringa Hausmann. Seringa was patiently waiting for a good weather day so she could get out to measure the spectral profile of green terrestrial Antarctica. The purpose of this is to measure what light mosses and lichens reflect to infer their distribution from satellite imagery. So you can map the distribution of mosses and lichens from looking at pixels from satellites. It's pretty cool. I caught up with her just after Christmas 2022 on her second visit down to Rothera. She was briefly passing through on the Sir David Attenborough before continuing onto Cygni Island. So, Seringa, welcome to the Ice World podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, so I'm Seringa Hausmann. That's a Dutch name. So I'm on the Dutch National Polar Programme, and we work together with BAS. So this is my second season down south. So last year we were together here at Rothera. Now we're in Rothera as well, but I'm actually on to Cygni Island to continue my research. And I'm a PhD student on a bigger project. And the project is all about terrestrial biodiversity, because we don't know a whole lot about that yet in the Antarctic. You're a marine, that's still a lot of mysteries, but there's a bit more research going on there. And so we're trying to figure out terrestrial biodiversity, and that it contains mosses and lichens, the vegetation, which is mainly my part, and then also the animals that live within it, the microbiomes, and all of it together we're trying to assess in a small team of PhDs and postdocs.
So let's go back to last year, last summer, 2021-2022 season at Rothera. How long were you on station?
I think about 2 months. It was strange because we had the quarantine first, of course, with COVID. I think in the end I had 7 weeks here on station.
It's not long.
It's not long for the goals that I had.
What were your tell me your main goals?
So one of my parts of the project is the spatial extent of the vegetation. So in the Antarctic, obviously there's not much vegetation because most of it is covered in snow and ice. But then here along the peninsula, we've got lots of mosses and lichens, but then actually nobody really knows where they are exactly and what they are, like what the species are doing, what their function is. So part of my project is to map, like make it spatially explicit. So where is this vegetation actually at? and what are the species. I've been able to analyze a little bit of my data of last year, and some things are really promising. You can actually, especially mosses, can have a very distinct spectrum. So then you could really, in the end, say, so just to simplify it, when you look at a pixel in a satellite photo and you see this pixel and it has a certain specific spectrum, you can be like, okay, this is probably a field of this type of moss. When you look at biodiversity, you not only look at the number of species, but you look at their function. So for example, you can have like three different species with exactly the same function in terms of CO2 like emissions, or like CO2 absorbance, exchange, rock erosion, providing habitat for a certain species. Like we have here, we have like the mites and the springtails. Mm-hmm. So these are all called like functional traits, and they can be the same for multiple species, but you can also, so then in theory, you could lose one species and that's not even,
you got that function too bad.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there may be other species that it's just one single species, but it's super important because it's the only one that really allows
that
for, exactly, or allows for like to hold moisture or that kind of thing. So, which is really important, of course, here in such an extreme environment. So we would stay in a hut on Lagoon. It's like a really basic hut. So you would take all your equipment, and especially you would have everything charged and loads of spare batteries, because batteries don't hold very long in the cold. So we basically stay in the hut and then go out every day and walk to the other side of the island, because the island has two parts. And that's already a bit of a challenge, because the part where the hut is like, that's not the most highly vegetated part. It's also not part of the protected area. So we have these ASPAs, the Antarctic Specially Protected Areas, but they're mostly marine. So we hardly have any on land. So we have Lagoon now, that's been an ASPA, and like a few more islands here that's been an ASPA since only like 2 years or so. So we're trying to get more of these areas to protect the most biodiverse and vulnerable parts. So Lagoon, we need the ASPA site for the measurement. So then you need to cross like the water, because at high tide these parts of the island are not connected. So you need waders, and like sometimes it gets like up to your waist. So you carry all your equipment through the water with all the elephant seals laying around looking at you like, huh, what are you doing here? And then you cross. And then, so I didn't only look at the reflectance, but I'm trying to also understand, like, to answer more fundamental ecological questions, like why is the composition like this? And also, how did these species end up here? You can't see the spores because they're tiny. So biosecurity is also a really important thing. That's why it takes ages for our samples to arrive, because you really need to quarantine them, and like you need to keep them in a safety lab, and because, well, the chances that like Antarctic mosses are gonna occupy the Netherlands are not really high, but you know, like you can't see these spores, so you have to be really careful. And that's why you also clean our boots so carefully, like every time we go on the island, even between here and Lagoon Island, we need to clean our boots, we need to clean our kit, because you can't see these spores and you really don't want to
bring them over to him.
Transfer them everywhere. So these spores are amazing. They can be dormant for like years and years. They can be frozen in soils and like snow and ice, and then
like
when the conditions are right, they just they pop up. Yeah, like tardigrades, which are part of the community as well.
I mean, it's absolutely massively ambitious to have mapped, or to want to map the whole island in 7 weeks. So do you succeed?
Well, I did. Yeah, I think I can say I've been pretty much everywhere on Lagoon. It's just like some parts are really hard to get through because the slopes would be really steep, or we have to deal with the cicuas, which are the birds that nest on Lagoon. Like there are really a lot of nests, so you have to be careful not to disturb them, and also they'll shoo you away. I mean, they will attack you if you come close. So some areas I just, you know, I left them to the cicuas.
What do you think the greatest challenges you experienced? You've touched on a few, but have you got a particular one?
It took very long last season for a real clear day to appear. And then what's frustrating as well is like, I think one day, so we used to get back into the weekends to station, if the weather allowed, to charge your devices and take a shower, which is also quite nice.
You basically lived on Lagoon Hut for the seven weeks.
Yeah, so I lived on Lagoon for 7 weeks, but then we would get back like 1 or 2 days in the weekend and get back out weather dependent. But then, so I remember the first clear day, it was like we'd been on the island for like 6 days in a row or something, and I think we also had to get back because I don't know why, because there were, I think there were icebergs, like, or like brush ice, like tiny icebergs. They were flown in, like flowing into the bay. So you guys also couldn't really
get trapped.
Exactly. So we had to go. So we come to the station, and like the next day it was clear, bright and sunny, but there was no way to go back to the island. No, so you're super frustrated. It's like, this is the day. So then I had to wait quite long for that one clear day to appear. And then I finally got to do like, so I remember we were in the middle of something else. We're just like on the complete other side of the island, like looking into something completely different. But then I saw the sun and I was like, okay, I gotta try. So I ran back to the hut, like got the device up and running. And then finally it stayed sunny for like a few hours. So I just basically ran over the entire island, measured everything, like didn't eat, didn't do any. I was like, I gotta get these measurements in.
But, and that was sufficient. So you managed to do all the measurements in that
sort of everything. Window. Yeah, at least capture all the important species and like community types. I had to work around that by collecting mosses and even, so I also collected some larger rocks, which is fun to do, like walk around with rocks in your rucksack.
And Serena, why do you care so much about moss and lichen? What got you into it? Like, of course, it's fascinating, but for you personally?
Yeah, for me personally. So for me, it more has to do with like, so I didn't work with mosses and lichens before, but so to me, it's more like that extreme environment thing that I find it fascinating that they're able to live here.
Extreme.
Well, yeah, so what we call extreme and to them is just easy peasy. I got really nerdy about the mosses and lichens in the app because they're actually fascinating when you start to study them.
You are. I think you're probably one of the most passionate people that I've met to speak about your work. And it's been super nice having you on the station and so cool to see you again. And what a fantastic way to end. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Seringa is still working at the University of Amsterdam and, like Mahaika, is in her final year of her PhD. Seringa is also collaborating with Floortje van den Heuvel, who we heard from in episode 6 of this series of the podcast. Together, they are looking at the role of moss spores in cloud formation. And if this array of science projects doesn't tempt you to work in Antarctica, then I don't know what will. Take a look at the job section of the British Antarctic Survey website. And as always, if you enjoyed the Ice World podcast, please keep following and sharing, and maybe even write a review for your favourite episode. Coming up, we will hear from the Doctors of Antarctica, Becky Boyes and Nisha Mystery. This is a really exciting episode. One recorded on station, one recorded at sea. So be sure to listen in 2 weeks' time. See you then, and thank you very much for tuning in.